Paul Nolte joins us now, Senior Wealth Manager and Market Strategist at Murphy and Silvest Wealth Management. Thanks for joining us, Paul. How are you today?
Good afternoon. We flipped the calendar over to June. It's still nice and warm, and Wall Street continues to heat up.
Yeah, the markets, so what are you saying, are doing well, and what's the explanation for that?
It's a good question because really for the month of May, it was all about artificial intelligence, and it was all about technology. There's difference between the performance of the very largest stocks was a huge compared to the rest of the market. Today, it seems like a little bit of catch-up. So we're getting a lot more participation. It's more of a homogenous market, if you will. And I think some of it has to do with Washington finally settling down, coming to their senses and saying, okay, we're going to put together a debt ceiling and we're going to pass a bill to allow us to pay our bills. Wall Street really wasn't too worried about it to start with, but I think this is something that's behind us now.
It's interesting you mentioned that, though. There was an interesting piece in the New York Times today, and the columnist was saying that the fact that a handful of stocks drive the NASDAQ, and maybe even the Dow or the S&P, but should we be worried that it's sometimes just a few companies that are elevating these indices or not? And while there's two ways to look at it, this particular person was pretty optimistic about the health of the markets overall. Are you?
Yeah. Well, historically, when you see that type of a divergence for a month or two, you normally will see the rest of the market catch up. What we're starting to see, I think, is echoes of 1999, where all you had to do was put .com on the end of your business name, and now you're an internet company. And we saw really prices of stocks getting well ahead of the fundamentals, whether it's earnings, revenue, et cetera. And it's not as pervasive today as it was in 99, and I don't think it's going to end in a similar fashion. But we certainly have those types of companies that are selling at very high multiples of both revenue and earnings that are not quite sustainable over the long term.
Does make you wish you'd put some money in a chip maker a few years ago, doesn't it?
You could have put it in NVIDIA in December and more than doubled your money, since Christmas. So it didn't have to be even a couple of years ago.
Yeah. Our colleague here, Steve Alexander, had what a $100 investment was, I forget, Steve, a few years ago. And it's now worth, $100,000 or something ridiculous like that. But that's stock picking, and that's about impossible to do for most of us.
It is. It requires, it requires some time, effort, and, again, how you value that company and what its true worth is. And sometimes it's not evident early on, and it takes a long time for that to really come to the fore.
Where are you on the interest rates? What do you think the Fed's going to do next?
The Fed has been remarkably consistent in telling you exactly what they're going to do. They're going to raise rates, and they have been saying it consistently for the past year, and they have followed through and have been raising rates consistently. And when you listen to the various Fed governors talking before they go into their quiet period, before this next meeting, they were saying the same thing. So I think we will see rates come up.
I thought that the attitude was coming out of the last meeting, especially with some of those bank failures that took some of the energy out of the market, that maybe we wouldn't have a rate increase. I thought it was going to be zero. No?
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you take a look at some of the data, the employment data is still pretty strong. Inflation, it's down some, but so nowhere near the 2% that the Fed is looking for. And in fact, the numbers that the Fed was looking at, their favorite number of the PCE, personal consumption expenditure index, is still running at 4.5%. So they're not comfortable that inflation is coming down fast enough. So that to them means we need to continue to raise rates.
Paul Nolte, CFA, Senior Wealth Manager and Market Strategist, Murphy and Silvest. You can visit murphysilvest.com for more. Paul, thanks for your help today.
No worries. We'll talk to you soon.
We visit Bree Fowler now, senior reporter at CNET. Bree, thanks for saying hi again. How are you?
Great. How's it going?
Good. We're in Chicago. The sun is shining. It's going to be a warm weekend. Taylor Swift's in town Friday, Saturday, Sunday. You don't have tickets for me, do you, Bree?
No, sorry. She played in New Jersey last weekend, and I got to experience the traffic, but not the show itself.
Yeah, I read the reviews in your paper there, and they were glowing. They say she put on a great show.
That's what I heard, too.
You know what? The tickets here now, if you are sitting in front of the front stage on the secondary market, speaking of tech, what would I pay for, would you guess, good seats in front, you know, front center for Taylor Swift tonight?
I don't know about good seats, but at the Meadowlands, they were going for about $10,000 for the weekend shows over Memorial Day.
Yeah.
So I don't even know what they would cost in Chicago, too.
I do, too, but I do. And it is, in fact, $10,260 is the secondary market. So we got that going for us. Let's speaking of money, where in the world is Amazon going to come up with $30 million to settle some lawsuits?
Well, Amazon has lots of money for Taylor Swift tickets or to deal with the FTC, which is what they're doing now. $30 million to settle violations of consumer privacy, what the FTC says are, including those of kids. They're saying that Amazon, you know, kept Alexa voice assistant recordings from Ring doorbells. And, you know, it let people have access to that information that it shouldn't have. You know, things like geolocation, like I said, voice recordings, and now they're going to have to pay for it.
I guess that's fair. $30 million doesn't sound like a big penalty. We're not saying that those are bad things to have, though, right? Those are generally good, safe, and secure, those Nest or Ring cameras, right?
Well, it depends on, you know, how the data is treated after it's gathered. I mean, you know, people like to have those kinds of devices. They think it might protect them from home invasions or having their Amazon packages stolen. But, you know, people have to remember that data is being collected and stored, just like, you know, anything that they say to their Amazon voice assistants. And devices at home. It's being collected and analyzed and, you know, in a lot of cases, shared with outside parties.
So if I'm saying something to my device, then maybe I'll get ads relative to what I've been saying, even though I wasn't asking for an ad from that other vendor?
Well, that's how they make money. That's definitely a big part of their business model. But, you know, there are rules for how they can do that, especially when it comes to kids. And that's why $25 million of what they're paying is to settle violations related to the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act. Companies cannot collect data from kids without parental consent. And, you know, it looks like Amazon may have broken some rules in that regard.
Although I don't know how they know if it's a kid or an adult.
Well, I mean, neither does Facebook or Instagram or TikTok, but, you know, their user agreements say that you're not supposed to use those kinds of social media if you're under 13. That's how they get around it. Now, there are a lot of kids under 13 using social media, and there are a lot of kids under 13 using smart speakers as well.
Well, I don't want to be naive about this, but watch. So if I say to my phone, hey, where's the nearest store to buy coffee pots? Is that captured and then sent to coffee pot sellers? And now I get populated with coffee pot ads. What happens?
Yeah. I mean, along with a lot of other data that's being collected, too. It's all these little nuggets that go to create a consumer profile of you. Companies pay big money for this. Amazon itself, you know, they're all about selling you stuff, and this is one way that they can target you with ads.
Which, you know, I have mixed feelings about. I mean, I did ask my phone to tell me where I can buy a coffee pot or whatever the heck it was, but that was a one-time, I thought, transaction with my phone. Now, for the next 6 months, I'm getting coffee pot ads, and I can't seem to unplug it, right? And that's sort of the fly we're always swatting away anymore.
Right. And something like that is really harmless. But, you know, maybe you asked your smart speaker or did a Google search even for healthcare information or about, you know, something a little more private and sensitive.
Right.
That's when things get a bit more hairy.
Talk to me about the new product that Apple is selling.
So Apple's Worldwide Developer Conference kicks off on Monday, and what we're hearing, the big centerpiece of their keynote and their announcement is going to be a $3,000 virtual reality headset that has been talked about forever and apparently is finally going to debut. There are other virtual reality and augmented reality headsets out there, and this is Apple kind of jumping in with their version of that.
That's right. I put on the helmet or the headset, and then I'm able to travel and throughout the world or play games or fight monsters or stuff like that, right?
Pretty much. That's kind of been the use for these kinds of devices so far. Maybe some more fitness-related type things. Mm-hmm. It'll be interesting to see how Apple, what their twist on this is. I mean, Facebook and Meta coined the metaverse, I mean, to the point where they even changed the name of the company to reflect that. Apple's going to have to put their own kind of unique twist on this in order to get a foot into that market.
Get a load of this. At the seniors complex where my parents live, I saw a little video screen of somebody with VR headsets on. And I thought, that's weird, because you normally see young people doing stuff with that. And then I thought, my mom and dad can't travel. But if they could put that on and they could somehow move through Paris or Washington, D.C., that would be transformative for them. Is that an application that is going to happen or is happening?
Oh, sure. I mean, actually, that kind of stuff has been around for years. I remember a long time ago going to see a demonstration at the American Museum of Natural History here in New York, where I canoed through the rainforest, and it was a very immersive experience, just to, you know, be able to look in a 360 way and yeah. see what was around me and hear the noises of the rainforest. It was very cool.
I'll get them a set. $3,000?
Yeah, that's what we're hearing. But the more players that jump into this market and the more it catches on, because right now it's still pretty fringy, prices will come down. It's just, you know, right now we haven't seen the kind of practical applications mm-hmm. that we have with other kinds of tech. I mean, it's not something that most people look at and go, oh, this is an essential accessory to my phone. But, you know, in all fairness, years ago, people looked at smartwatches that way, too.
Yeah, who thought you had to have a camera in your pocket? And now we all do. Bree Fowler is a senior reporter at CNET. Okay, I've eaten up all of our time, Bree. It's always fascinating to talk to you. Thanks for visiting with us.
Thanks for having me.
Right now, let's start with Ted Rossman, senior industry analyst at Bankrate. And you've got some interesting things to say about inflation and some of the sectors of the economy, Ted. I'm reading your piece here, and I'm a little surprised by some of this. How are you?
Doing well. Thanks for having me.
So airline fares factor in how overall?
This is actually one of the larger jumps in the consumer price index, up 2.7% on a month-over-month basis. The year-over-year figure is actually down a little bit, but I think really the biggest trend is versus 2 years ago. Airfares are up more than 30% from 2 years ago, and I think that's really emblematic of travel in general. Hotel costs are up about 25% over the past 2 years. Restaurant meals are up about 16%. It's really increasingly costly to travel, and yet so many people are doing it anyway.
So I hate to say this, but so is this a good thing or bad thing if prices go up or down? You know, we've got the Fed that wants a recession, for crying out loud, and you think that would be a bad thing, but that seems to be the fix. So when I hear that prices on anything are going up or down, I don't know if that's good or bad for the economy.
It's very interesting. You're right. There are a lot of contradictions out there because people are pulling back on physical goods spending. In fact, just recently, Macy's and Costco came out with disappointing earnings, basically saying that people are avoiding discretionary purchases, especially of physical goods. And yet at the same time, travel is growing like gangbusters. I mean, it's amazing. I think a lot of it has to do with pandemic effects. And I think there's all this pent-up demand. I actually thought that trend would have been more played out last year.
Yeah.
Remember last summer, everybody talked about revenge travel and things are opening up. And I would have thought maybe that faded and maybe recession worries and inflation would lead to less travel this year. But what we're seeing people decide by and large is that they'd rather cut back on other things and they'd prioritize these experiences.
Yeah, we kind of talked about that a little earlier when we were wondering why people spend so much money on Taylor Swift tickets. But it's not the objects, it's the experiences anymore. And you may have seen the story that I did, and it was one of the major cruise lines. Was it Royal Caribbean, maybe, that is booking ships at 101% capacity? They're taking suites for two people, and sometimes there are three people in there. The cruise ships are packed these days, to certain parts of the world anyway.
Yeah, I think cruises are an especially interesting example because they were slower to recover. I think people were especially worried about being in close proximity and also the international nature. I mean, lest we forget, last summer was pretty normal domestically, but there were still a lot of international testing requirements and COVID worries. So that's actually another big trend this year. A lot of cruises are international, of course, so that factors in. But flights, too. I mean, we're hearing about tons of people going to Europe and Asia and Africa and really all over the world. Sometimes it's these long delayed bucket list trips. I mean, I've heard of plenty of people that they were supposed to go on a safari 3 years ago and they're only now doing it. Same thing with trips to Italy and France and all these other places. Pent up demand is a real thing.
It's still out there. So you write, I continue to be worried about the cumulative effects of inflation. Travelers are certainly noticing 80% of likely summer vacationers are making changes due to inflation. How so?
This is another sort of contradiction because, as we've said, people want to travel and they are traveling. We think there'll be more travelers this summer than last, but they're not writing a blank check for travel. Like, they are willing to make some adjustments. So we're talking about maybe picking cheaper accommodations or cheaper activities, cheaper destinations, you know, maybe traveling for fewer days or driving instead of flying. I think these are all smart adaptations. I would add a few more to the list. One would be use rewards points and miles. That can be a great way to offset costs. And also maybe consider zigging when others zag. You know, maybe you travel in the off season or the shoulder season, or maybe you fly midweek instead of on the weekend, or you let the deal dictate the destination. I think flexibility can be really key.
Yeah, no kidding. But do put it on your credit card, right?
If you can pay it off in full and avoid interest, then I love the idea of using a credit card. You don't want to carry debt, though. The average credit card charges more than 20%. That's a record high. It's roughly half and half in terms of cardholders who pay in full versus those who don't. It's just a tremendous difference. You know, we have one half basically trapped in this expensive debt cycle. The other half, life is great. I mean, you're getting free trips in some cases, maybe access to the airport lounge. It's just so important to pay in full if you can.
Ted Rossman's on the line from Bankrate.com. Is there a card that is best for travel?
I tend to think it's best to keep your options open. So I like the transferable points cards, the ones that have numerous airline and hotel transfer partners. The Chase Sapphire Reserve and the Chase Sapphire Preferred are two popular examples. Amex has a number of options as well. The Platinum Card, the Gold Card, those are a couple that come to mind. Capital One has that Venture Card, which is really kind of the ultimate in simplicity because they have transfer partners, but you can also book basically any travel and offset it at a set rate that essentially amounts to like a 2% cashback card, but dedicated to travel. So that's one that can really give you a lot of flexibility.
Well, does it ever make sense just to take the points, turn them into cash, and then use the cash to for travel, or is the multiplier better if you don't take the cash but use it in the direct purchase of airplane tickets?
The transfer partners are typically the most lucrative, but they're also more complicated. So maybe you could transfer points and get an $8,000 first class airline ticket for 100,000 points. You know, that would be 8 cents per point or mile. Whereas cash back, you know, you're probably talking a 2% return would be pretty solid across the board there. But that said, the transfer partners can be complicated. you sometimes have to put in more work, or you have to be flexible enough to travel on the optimal dates. A middle ground is something like that Capital One venture where you could potentially do both. Some people treat this like a game and they have numerous cards and they maximize every last cent, but others would rather just keep it simple. So I do think you need to know yourself and your habits.
You know, I think one of the smartest things you said, and you say a lot of smart things, is maybe let the deal dictate the destination. If you can get, you know, if you don't care where you're traveling to, you've got a range of things, see where the best deal is and go there, right, Ted?
That's right. So often people do the opposite. They get their heart set on a specific place at a specific time, and that just becomes very limiting. So if you want to go to the beach and you don't care which beach, shop around. See where they have cheaper flights and cheaper accommodations. And, you know, if all else fails, think about a staycation. That's something about a quarter of summer vacationers are planning. There are lots of great things to do in the Chicago area. Don't let your vacation time go unused.
Ted Rossman, Senior Industry Analyst, Bankrate.com. Thank you, Ted.
No problem. Thank you.
More business news on the Wintrust Business Lunch with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. The Civic Committee of the Commercial Club wants Chicago to be the safest big city in America. The group, which represents some of the city's biggest companies, says it will raise tens of millions of dollars and hire at-risk individuals with the goal of making Chicago safer. The Civic Committee of the Commercial Club says its goal is to cut the number of homicides by 75% over the next decade and reduce the number of shootings. Among other things, the group is proposing an expansion of violence intervention programs and investments in long-neglected neighborhoods. A men's clothing company featured on the TV show Shark Tank is opening a store in Chicago. Cranes reports Collars & Company will open next week in the shops at Northbridge on Michigan Avenue. The company currently has an online presence only. Collars & Company specializes in polo shirts with dress collars that can be worn under a sweater or with a suit. The company appeared on Shark Tank last year, and since then, sales have skyrocketed 400%. The MacMiles store will be small at just 1,000 square feet. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
The business of food with Steve Alexander.
Okie doke, and let's go ahead and get this out of the way.
Ooh, I'd sell my soul for a donut.
Well, you don't need to sell your soul. Tomorrow's National Donut Day, and finding a free one shouldn't be too hard. And more about that after I tell you we're sponsored by the Chevy Silverado HD. Experience your life in HD. Visit ChevyDriveChicago.com. Okay, free donuts tomorrow. The national chains Dunkin' and Krispy Kreme have some giveaways going on. So does Stan's, the Chicago chain, where you can get a free glazed donut with a purchase. And Stan's chief doughboy, Rich Labriola, told me while glazed is perhaps the most boring of donuts.
It's not easy to make a great glazed donut. A glazed donut is the centerpiece of someone's skill.
Got it. Okay, let's move on to mac and cheese. Free mac and cheese tomorrow, first responder, first Friday at Top This Mac and Cheese in Hyde Park.
Taking care of first responders is something we started doing during the pandemic.
Healthcare workers and first responders can eat for free.
You just show up with a ID or a uniform, and it's very simple. We're happy to take care of you.
Chef Damar Brown.
So this is just a small thank you from us to them.
And we're not talking run-of-the-mill mac and cheese.
Correct.
The name of the restaurant, Top This, is a hint.
We have things like teriyaki pork belly on top, the classic bacon, plain mac and cheese, there's a roasted vegetable one, buffalo fried chicken, buffalo fried shrimp. There's things for, you know, everybody.
Plenty of it.
Yeah, it's pretty substantial. It's about a pound of food. It's enough to share.
Till supplies last.
But we haven't had that issue of running out yet. We're pretty well equipped.
Top This Mac and Cheese in Hyde Park.
We open at 11 and close at 8.
And if you're a first responder, you eat for free tomorrow.
These people take care of everyone else, so I thought that was a nice thought to take care of them.
And by the way, Chef Brown is a James Beard nominee. He will find out Monday night if he's the winner in the Emerging Chef category. From the farm to your belly, today is World Milk Day, it's National Hazelnut Cake Day, and, just in case anything gets stuck, it's National Heimlich Maneuver Day. I'm Steve Alexander, and that's the business of food on 720 WGN.
Jingmai O'Connor is the dinosaur curator at the Field Museum. Welcome to WGN. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me. I'm excited to tell you about the big dinosaur things coming to our museum this summer.
Yeah, this June. I'm just reading from your notes. The Field Museum will become the only place in the Western Hemisphere to see the world's largest predatory dinosaur, a prehistoric river monster. What are we talking about here?
So it's a dinosaur that a lot of people are familiar with, I guess, thanks to, I think it was Park 3, but it is Spinosaurus. And it's a really, really unique dinosaur. Not only is it bigger or longer, and the skull is bigger than the T-Rex, but it is also the only non-avian dinosaur that's ever evolved to swim in water and as its main way of, you know, of feeding itself. And I just want to correct, not only is this the only Spinosaurus in the Western Hemisphere, this is the most scientifically accurate Spinosaurus in the world. So there's one other cast that's out there that's in Hong Kong, but since that cast was made, additional bones of Spinosaurus were discovered by a team that includes a field museum scientist, Matteo Fabri. And so our cast includes all that aren't in the only other existing cast that's in Asia.
Jingmei, I've never heard of a Spinosaurus. Is that what you call it?
Yeah. So you've never heard of Spinosaurus. It has a really interesting story, actually. So it was first found in 1912 by a German paleontologist, and the one skeleton that ever existed was destroyed during World War II. And just in about 10 years ago, this new specimen was found. But of course, it's a huge dinosaur, so you can't dig it out in one go. So over many successive seasons, this team led by a paleontologist named Nizar Ibrahim have slowly uncovered this fantastic new specimen, which have allowed us to, for the first time, see all these adaptations that tell us that provide really strong evidence that Spinosaurus was a swimming dinosaur.
How much of the skeletal remains were recovered? What percentage of the actual dinosaur exists?
So that's a good question. And I should, and for next time somebody asks me, I'm going to have the exact number prepared. But I would estimate at this point that it's about 70% of the skeleton.
Wow. Wow. Because I'm curious sometimes how well, sometimes it's like they have a tooth. And then they say, based on this tooth, we know all of these things. It's amazing to me how much scientists are able to sort of determine from sometimes the most minimal remains.
Well, yeah, but all of that does need to be taken with a grain of salt. You know, if all you have is a tooth, then yeah, you're going to try to get as much information as you can out of that tooth. But you also have to recognize that maybe when you find a leg or a tail, to show that your hypotheses were wrong. But in this case, we really do have the majority of the animal. And there's also other Spinosaurus, close relatives of Spinosaurus, that have been found in other parts of the world that also help us to fill in the gaps a little bit. But Spinosaurus is really distinct. It's really unlike any other dinosaur. It has this big sail on its back, kind of like Dimetrodon, which is probably an ornamental structure that looks more like an eel or like some kind of, like amphibian that lives in water. So it really seems that it had this paddle-like tail for moving itself through water. But really, the kicker is that all the bones are super dense. And we only see this in animals that that live in water. And of course, you think have denser bones, but only in the legs. But animals that effectively foraging, swimming underwater, pursuing prey, have dense bones throughout the skeleton. And that's what we see in Spinosaurus. So, it's oddly controversial. There are a lot of people who don't like this idea that Spinosaurus was, subaquatic or, spending a lot of the time in water. But us at the Field Museum are following the science, and we've really leaned into it. So we're hanging the specimen from the ceiling in a swimming posture, and it's going to be so cool.
I'm glad you're doing what you're doing, and I appreciate that description. 4 feet longer than Sue, 95 million years ago, roaming or swimming the earth, 46 feet long with a crocodile-like snout. What an amazing thing. Okay, so in June, is it there now, Jingmei? Can I see it soon?
So the team who has produced the cast for us is here, and they're assembling the skeleton. So if you'd like to see it, come by Saturday, and that's the official opening where the public will be able to see the specimen in all its glory. And then in order to celebrate this new arrival, we're having a Dino Fest on June 10th, which is going to be fun for the family. I'll be giving a little presentation about, you know, if we had a time machine and we could, you know, have T-Rex and Spinosaurus battle, like who would win and why, talk about, you know, how each predator is equipped. And then there'll also be other, like there'll be a dinosaur book fair and dinosaur poetry.
Dino Fest is going to be from 11 to 2 on June 10th at Stanley Field Hall. Wow. I love the enthusiasm and I love the display. I haven't seen it yet, but I'm very anxious to get there. Thanks for the heads up and have a great June, Jingmei.
Thank you so much. Hope to see you at the museum.
You will. That's Jingmei O'Connor, dinosaur curator, can you tell, at the Field Museum.